your silence is commanded.
May you all be seated, please. Our third case today is 05AP685, Acuity Mutual Insurance Company versus Miguel A. Olivas. Representing Acuity Mutual is Samuel C. Rusatsky. Did I pronounce your name correctly? Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Samuel Wozotsky. I represent Acuity Mutual Insurance Company. With me today is my co-counsel, William Soxie. The question before the court today in this matter is whether Wisconsin is going to have a balanced workers' compensation system. When I say balanced, I mean whether the premiums, the inflows that come into the system, do they bear any relation to the outflows, the benefits that are paid out to injured workers under the system? I submit to you that a balanced system is what the Wisconsin legislature designed, but an imbalanced system is what the Court of Appeals decision in this case would result in. Brief summary of the facts in this case. Miguel Olivas, the defendant and respondent, is a drywaller. He works with a group of acquaintances, and he went to Steve Tempest Drywall seeking work. Mr. Tempest owns his own company, told Mr. Olivas, I'll only give you work if you have your own liability and workers' compensation policies. Olivas went to an insurance agent and said, I need workers' comp, and a liability policy to be able to get jobs from Steve Tempest, so I would like those policies. And noted in the synopsis available to the public that there's a suggestion that maybe the other workers that Mr. Olivas worked with did not come to light until the audit period. But the testimony at trial was very, very clear that when Mr. Olivas went to the agent in the first place, he said, I need a policy for my crew. Mr. Olivas testified to that point at trial. Mr. Flores argued that point to the trial judge. So the policy was purchased up front to provide coverage for the crew that has now become the issue in this case.
So why didn't he get a policy that covered the crew?
We submit, Your Honor, that the policy does cover the crew.
Okay. So the problem is it covers the crew, but he didn't give you that it had enough revenue from the business. Is that the point?
That's the point, Your Honor. The way workers' comp policies operate is there's an initial estimate on the premium basis. Policies, workers' comp, as you can imagine, different workers have different risks of injury. So the rates are determined by first determining what sort of workers we're dealing with, and that results in a particular rate. And that rate is applied to the premium basis, which in workers' compensation is payroll. The payroll estimate when the policy was purchased was $25,000.
Isn't that a bit difficult to swallow, that the crew payroll together with Mr. Olivas is going to have a total annual payroll of $25,000?
I don't think so, Justice Bradley. The initial estimate has to be a forecast. For subcontractors, they may have no idea in December or January how much work they're going to have throughout the year. And I guess...
I'm going to just make this up. I'm making this up. Let's say in my mind, if someone says crew to me, crew means minimum two or three people. One person doesn't mean a crew working for me. I'm just making this up. So two or three people. Could be 10, 15, 20, but minimum two or three people. Is it realistic to say Olivas plus two or three people is going to have an annual payroll of $25,000? Maybe it is, but that would seem to put a light on, some switch a light on of warning.
Well, I don't think, Justice Bradley, I would disagree for this reason, that the other feature of a workers' comp policy is that understanding that the premium basis is payroll, and you're trying to determine the ultimate premium based on what the payroll actually is, the workers' comp policy provides for an audit after the end of the policy period.
I know, but you want the estimate to be realistic for the audit so that you don't have the kind of circumstance that you have here.
Well, understandably, but the reality is you're probably not going to be exact. And at the end of the day, what you really want to get at, whether the initial estimate was too high or too low, and again, there's no testimony in the record at trial in this case where that $25,000 came from, who picked it. Did Mr. Oliva say, I'm not sure how much work I'm going to have, so let's do $25,000. At the end of the day, the audit is what the premium is really calculated. The final premium is based on the audit. And so, yes, in this circumstance, the final audit determined that the payroll, the proper payroll to apply was $170,000. So additional premium was owed. But the reverse is true. If the initial estimate had been, we think we're going to have a great year. And again, this will apply to all employers. So if the initial estimate is we're going to have a great year, our payroll is going to be $1 million. And then June rolls around and for whatever reason, there's a downturn in the particular industry and people have to get laid off. And you get to the end of the policy period and there's an audit. And lo and behold, the payroll, the premium basis, is determined. It wasn't $1 million. It was only $750,000. The way the policy is written, the agreement is the employer's entitled to a refund. So the issue is, at the end of the day, the goal of the policy, of the agreement, and the workers' compensation system is to have a system where the final premiums are based on the actual payroll.
Counsel, can I ask a question? Because I don't pretend that this is my area of expertise and I need help. I'm looking at the insurance policy. And I'm looking at the plaintiff's appendix at page 95 and then again at page 153. And when I look at the policy, it says first named insured is individual. Additional named insureds, who is an insured includes the following additional named insureds, none. I go to page 153 at the audit, it says billing direct bill insured is individual. So when I look at those, you've talked in the terms of this being a policy for a number of individuals. Am I not looking in the right place? Should I be looking elsewhere to see who else is covered by this policy? Because all I found so far is that it's Mr. Olivas.
Justice Butler, the answer to that question is the individual employees are not going to be listed in the policy. A workers' comp policy covers employees, and the workers' compensation liability is the liability of the employer. So this named insured on PBAP 137, I think you've referenced, and then also in the audit, Mr. Olivas is listed as an individual as opposed to a corporation or a limited liability company. So that's all that's going to tell you. And again, who's covered in the policy is identified as the employees.
And again, each of the following is also an insured, your employees. says who's an insured. It says your employees are insured. Well, that's page 104.
Thank you, Chief.
So exactly what was the employee-employer relationship? What was it? What did he have? In other words, they were all drywaller. They brought their own equipment.
The testimony at trial was they each had their own hammers or nails or whatever it was.
Okay.
But Mr. Olivas went and got the jobs, found out where the jobs were, what the jobs entailed, and took that information back to the crew.
Now, in drywalling, I'm sorry, please.
No, go ahead.
In drywalling, I know this much about drywalling, and let the record reflect my fingers are separated by an eighth of an inch. I know nothing about drywalling. But you need some supplies for drywalling. Don't you need tape in between the seams and things in drywalling?
You need the drywall.
Okay, I'm going to get to that. But don't you need the tape?
No.
Yes.
Who supplies the tape?
I don't think there's any testimony in the record that tells us who supplied the tape.
Who supplied the drywall?
I think the testimony at trial was that Steve Tempest Drywall supplied the drywall.
What other materials besides the drywall did Steve Tempest provide?
Materials?
Yeah, I asked about the tape. You don't know.
Right.
Drywall, you do know. Materials to do the job. What else is needed to do a drywall job?
Justice Bradley, I don't profess to be a drywall expert myself. The testimony in the transcript, I think, speaks to the hammers and the drywall, and I'm not sure there's much detail in there about who supplied the other materials.
Or if there are.
I'm wondering, what makes you think that Olivas is an employer here? Why isn't he an employee of Tempest? Why? Show me how he meets the independent contractor test.
How Mr. Olivas
meets
the independent contractor test?
Does he meet all of those nine factors to be an independent contractor?
I don't think he has to. Why is he an employer? He's an employer for two reasons. One, he bought a policy. And so
that's what you're hanging your hat on. Primarily, he bought a policy, okay. But does he meet the nine requirements? Now, let me try to be a little clear. So one of the problems is, in this kind of arrangement, you don't want the workers' comp law to be circumvented, to have an employer say to all the employees, you're all independent contractors. We don't have to deal with this stuff. And so you don't want that. The legislature didn't want that. That's why they came up with these definitions. You know, I'm kind of certain about this, all of this stuff. And in preparing for this case, it seems to me that Olivas very well may be an employer of Tempest. Why isn't he an employee, rather, of Tempest?
Because he's an employer under the statute. And so under 102.
He's only an employer if he has an employees. And isn't that the subject question before us? Does he have employees?
Justice Bradley, I disagree. He can't be Tempest's employee because 102.07.8M
says you can't be both.
I know.
But I'm not saying he's both. I'm saying maybe he's only one, and that is he is the employee of Tempest. And as the employee of Tempest, then he cannot be the employer of anyone else under the statute. Why isn't he the employee of Tempest under the statutory definitions of employee and independent contractor?
The answer, Justice Bradley, is he can't be Tempest's employee because he's an employer.
He's only an employer because he happened to buy your insurance.
That's right.
The result, if you follow Justice Bradley to a logical conclusion,
which
is,
may be difficult, but
maybe difficult, but we'll try, is that he, Olivas, is an employee of Tempest, that everybody else, for the same reason that Olivas is an employee of Tempest, everybody else is an employee of Tempest. Therefore, you ought to give him his money back because you took money from him when he can't buy this policy because he is not an employer.
Well, you see, I took a
you, you just, that's right. You went to the – I was logical. She got a little illogical at the end.
No, no, because well, he bought nothing from you because he doesn't fit the – I mean, that's
I think he's – he very well could be an employee of Tempus. And under the statute, you can't be both. You're absolutely right.
Well,
and to put it, it, what's so different between him and his crew? So if he, you're adamant that he's not an employee, then why are his crew employees?
Why are they, they're employees, what? If the question is, are they employees or independent contractors, then, and we're talking about the crew now, because I think what we need to come back to is the issue here is he purchased the policy. And if we're going to suggest that when you have a policy that's been purchased to provide coverage for employees under the statute, that down the road, we can still say, you know what, he purchased a policy, but he shouldn't have purchased a policy. So we're going to undo the policy, some sort of rescission remedy. I mean, that seems to me to call into question, it raises a whole host of other
problems.
I'm not
doing that. Let me just focus. This is exactly what I want to know. What is the relationship of Olivas to Tempus? I think you would say he's an independent contractor. I think you would say that. Is that correct or is that incorrect?
I wouldn't say he's an independent contractor because of 102.07.8b.
Okay, then what is he? He is something.
He's
a nice guy.
He's a subcontractor.
A subcontractor to whom?
To Tempus. He's a subcontractor. The
He's
problem
an independent
is,
subcontractor, too. That's why Tempus wanted him to go out and get his own insurance. He's an independent
subcontractor.
Okay. That's what you have to find him in all of your thinking. You have to say that he's an independent subcontractor to Tempus, and then you're saying he's an employer to this crew. But let me challenge you on your first premise. Look at the statute and see if he meets all nine requirements of being a subcontractor. Does he maintain a separate business with his or her office equipment, materials, and other facilities?
Right.
That's sub one. Sub four seems to me a problem. Does he incur the expenses related to the service or work that he or she performs under contract? Tempus is providing all the drywall. What other yes, back and forth to work, normal, you know, travel.
Justice Bradley, maybe I didn't mean to interrupt, but I know you're looking at 102.07 because I was going to fill in the blanks and ask two and
please
three.
Please do.
Well, no,
please,
I just
you know,
thought
go
that.
Go ahead. Please do. He'll take us through these, but
no,
please do.
No, but we should go through. I thought we'd go through them because I think your point is well taken, that we want to establish whether or not what this person is. Did Mr. Olivas hold or applied for a federal employer identification number with a federal Internal Revenue Service or has filed business?
There's nothing in the record that would support saying he did.
This was never raised at the trial court level.
Okay.
So there's nothing in the record.
So this is an issue. What you're saying is that this is an issue that this court should not be dwelling on.
Well, the issue is, what is Mr. Olivas' liability for additional premiums? He purchased a policy, and the policy, as the Chief Justice points out, covers his employees within the meaning of the statute, which would include statutory employees. So if we're going to look at the nine tests you have to apply with respect to the crew. But as to Mr. Olivas,
you're assuming a condition precedent that doesn't that may not exist here. You're saying that he's an employer to these employees, right?
Yes, he's a statutory employer. Yes.
And I'm asserting that he likely is an employee of Tempus because he's not a subcontractor. Before you can assert that he is an employer, you have to have as a condition precedent that he is a subcontractor to Tempus. And I don't think he is.
Justice Bradley, if Mr. Olivas had not purchased a policy to cover workers' compensation benefits, this could be a very different case than it is. The danger that I see if we engage in this sort of analysis is the next case that comes up, an employer purchases a policy to provide coverage, and it turns out there are independent contractors like those here that we submit don't meet the nine tests. So under the statute, they would be employees and entitled to benefits. Are we then suggesting that the employer can turn around and say, well, I bought a policy, or the insurance company? Do we want the insurance company to say, well, we sold them the policy, but we shouldn't have, so there is no coverage? We're just going to end up with more and more disputes. Whereas the reverse, taking the given that he purchased the policy to provide coverage for the crew, that's what he wanted. That's what he testified at trial. He wanted a policy to cover the crew. Applying the 9-point test of 10207-8B will simplify decisions. It will reduce litigation.
Let me, if I might interrupt you at this point. What I'd like to do is focus for a minute on the burden of proof. My understanding is there's a trial at the circuit court level. Mr. Olivas is claiming that he's an independent contractor. Acuity is saying, no, you're an employer, and you owe us a lot more money in terms of premium. Who has the burden of establishing that he's an employer and not an independent contractor?
Justice Crooks, I think the burden, the Court of Appeals correctly pointed out that this is a contract case. So Acuity was the plaintiff. But the argument, as I understand what Mr. Olivas argued and what the trial court decided, was that he was an employer as to Mr. Olivas, and the key issue is the other members of the crew, whether they're independent contractors or not.
Well, let me take it one step further. You're the plaintiff.
Correct.
You've got the burden of proof. Did you establish, and how did you establish, that he was not an independent contractor, but rather an employer? How was that established to the trial court?
Well, it's a contract case, and Right. Under the terms of the contract, he's identified as the employer. And the statute specifies that he's an employer. So I think the record is very clear.
Counsel, if I can focus you in right there, because I think you and Justice Bradley have been talking past each other, and I want to get you on the same page. If you're arguing that this is a statutory employer, then the policy doesn't matter. You're arguing the statute, correct? The statute applies. So I think what Justice Bradley was looking for and what I'm looking for is where in the statute is Olivas defined as an employer? It's not just the purchase of the contract that it controls. It's where in the statute is he a statutory employee?
Sub 1, sub E. A person who elects to be an employer under the Act, under 10205, and 10205, sub 2, employer shall enter in a contract for the insurance of compensation, shall be deemed thereby to have elected to accept the provisions of this chapter.
Thank you.
Let me go back, though. You say sub E, because sub 2 of 10205 just talks about presumes once you are an employer. So you're getting your statutory definition of employer on 10204.
1E.
1E. And that requires, who has any person in service under any contract of hire, express or implied.
Prior to the time of the injury to the employee, the crew.
And it has elected to become subject to the provisions of this chapter.
As provided in 10205.
And who shall not, prior to such accident, have effected a withdrawal.
So if somebody's injured while the policy is in force, he's an employer. So I see my red light is on.
Isn't that an employer under 1B? Is that it? Because everybody's an employer if they employ three or more employees. You're saying he doesn't fall within that.
Well, he could, but I think that takes you back to the question of does he have three employees, but that just brings us back in a circle. But in any event, again, the case is about the liability for the premiums under the policy.
Now, well, 102.075 allows a sole proprietor to elect to be to take out his own policy, whether he's an employee or not.
102.075.
So you have two elections here. One potential, one by 10205 by an employer and the other by an employee.
The employer, right, he elects to be covered as an employer under the Act, but if he wants the policy to cover him personally,
that's
he elects under 10207.
Right.
Counselor, before you get off, I've been kind of waiting to ask a question. What parts of 8B in the trial record do you argue were not fulfilled by Mr. Olivas's crew?
Justice Rogensack, the determinative one, because the test under 8B is you have to satisfy all.
I know.
So at a minimum, the crew, there's no evidence in the record that the crew satisfied sub 2, that the crew had employer ID numbers, and we submitted as part of the appendix some helpful, we think, documents from the IRS that explain what an employer ID number is. And the alternative way to meet sub 2 is to have filed returns and paid self-employment tax. And again, we've...
As a sole proprietor.
Right. Schedule SE or Schedule C, which again would get the tax as a self-employed individual.
Okay. Just focusing on that one criteria, whose burden was it to show that these things were not present? Was it your burden to show they were not, or was it Mr. Olivas's burden to show they were?
We believe that it's Mr. Olivas's burden to show that all nine elements exist, because he's asserting that meeting the independent contractor test would take those crew members out of the definition of employee. So there's really symmetry in that argument, too, when you do have the compensation case where somebody's injured, that the person opposing compensation has to establish the nine tests. And we think the symmetry here should be that the employer who's contending he shouldn't have to pay premium for certain individuals should be the one that has the burden to come forward, because, frankly, the crew members are under their control.
Could I ask you if the court were to find that these folks were independent contractors, does that make Acuity immune from liability under the policy if one of those people were injured?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. In this particular instance, maybe that takes us back to the policy as a nullity, but as I understand it, and again, typically when a premium is determined you know, outside of litigation, whether somebody was included in the premium basis at the front end is not determinative at all as to whether that person is entitled to compensation when they're actually injured. So now I suppose for the purposes of this specific case, if the court were to issue some ruling that these folks were independent contractors, you know, that I suppose takes us to issues of claim preclusion or some sort of similar defense that Acuity might be able to raise, but geez, I have more research to do on that point. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Flores, representing Miguel Olivas.
May it please the court, I'm Ness Flores. I represent Mr. Miguel Olivas. Present with me is co-counsel, my associate, Paul Bugenhagen. Before I get into the facts of the case, let me make a couple of quick points. It has been Miguel Olivas's contention from the very beginning that the co-workers working with him were not his employees. And that was the thrust of the testimony at the trial. Acuity sued Olivas for premiums because after he obtained the policy and when he told them that his income he thought was going to be $25,000, after the premium year, they did an audit. The auditor testified that the only thing she saw were 1099s that Olivas had given to his fellow co-workers. And based on the fact that Mr. Olivas could not produce certificates of insurance, led her to believe that they were his employees. That was it. And if you think, you were asking Justice Bradley about how could he have been off so much, $25,000, when he purchased that policy, and I submit he wasn't that far off, because he went to get a policy for himself. Because Tempa said, I need you guys to have insurance, workers' comp insurance. He went, he didn't say I need a policy for my crew. That's not the testimony. I tried this case, and he said, we need workers' comp insurance. And when you take the total amount that was stated today here of the total payroll that Tempest paid to these workers, when you divide it by six workers, it comes out to $28,000. So Olivas was almost right on the money. That's how much his share of that would have been.
Well, now the requirement was from Tempest that nobody worked for him that didn't have had the insurance.
Right.
So Tempest never checked anybody else except Olivas, or was
We don't know if he checked anybody.
Or was that because Olivas held himself out as the
crew leader?
Crew leader.
Well, I'll get to that. Olivas told the auditor, when the auditor said, do any of the other workers have insurance? He said, and it's in the testimony and the record, I think several of them do. She said, do you have their certificates of insurance? He said, no. She said, get them and mail them to me. And this gets to the burden of proof. She testified that she never got that. I asked her in cross-examination, did you contact the other workers to see if they had insurance? She said, that's not my responsibility. That is Olivas, as a business owner, that is Olivas' responsibility. And this goes to our whole basis here, that the burden of proof was on Acuity. The trial court said,
burden of proof to show what?
To show whatever they were going to show, because they were trying to collect more premiums by saying that these fellow workers were employees of Olivas and Olivas owned more premiums. So they had the burden of showing that they were employees of Olivas. The trial court said, I find that these fellows were not employees under Chapter 102, which means that there was not a Chapter 102 employer-employee relationship. Now, all of the testimony at the trial was by, first of all, they had two witnesses, the auditor who said all she really saw were the 1099s, and she said from that and the fact that Olivas did not have an insurance certificate, she concluded that they were like employees.
Well, just you can enlighten me. When you send out a 1099, were these separate 1099s or was it all one?
Okay. Let me tell you what happened here, Your Honor. Olivas and four or five friends were looking for work. Now, all of these were of Mexican descent workers. Olivas, and the record supports this, was the only one who had a Social Security number, the only one who had a permanent resident status. He had immigration papers. The only one who could speak any English, which was very limited. And so Olivas knew that Tempest had a drywall company. The crew went there, and Tempest says, I need you fellas. I can't hire you unless you have workers' comp insurance and liability insurance. And that's all Tempest testified. He never testified that he checked it or who had it or who didn't.
Did you say the crew went there or that Olivas went
there? Well, we don't know who was present but at the time. But it was the understanding, as I read the testimony, that and Tempest testified that he would see the crew working. And he paid, Olivas testified that he was paid, the one who was paid by Tempest, because he was the only one who had a Social Security number. Tempest didn't want to be paying wages to somebody without a Social Security number.
Didn't he have an EIN rather than a Social Security number?
There's no testimony that he had an EIN. He did testify that he had his papers and so on.
Thank you.
So Tempest knew this, and he was satisfied that he was... No, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but apparently he knew the arrangement.
Oh, yes, he testified. When I asked him, or he was asked, why this arrangement, he said, why did he require workers' comp insurance? He said, because that way I don't have to pay for it, and that way I don't have to check the background of the workers. He said, that's his testimony. So, this was the arrangement. Tempest also testified that he would deal with Olivas, because Olivas was the guy who could speak the most English. Not much, because the auditor said she had a hard time communicating with him, and he had an interpreter there who didn't speak much English either. So that's all she looked at, the 1099s, and concluded they were employees.
Mr. Flores, now, was Olivas paid in cash or by check?
Check.
And only one check was issued and only to Olivas, is that correct?
Yes. And then the testimony was that the workers would all get together and divide the check, that Olivas made no profit from them, did not withhold for taxes, FICA, Social Security, or anything like that.
Did Tempest withhold taxes?
No, not that I'm aware. I don't think there was any testimony to that.
He said he didn't.
Well, Mr. Flores, if one of these co-workers had been injured, what would have happened?
Well, here's the interesting part. Every case cited by Acuity differs from this case in one very important respect. There was no injury here. There were no claims here. We are dealing with a fight over premiums. Now, had they, you put a hypothetical, had a worker reported an injury, if you look at the exhibit, the policy says that there's an exclusion for any worker knowingly hired, presumably by Olivas, because that's who they claim is the employer, knowingly hired by Olivas who is illegally hired. The testimony was clear that none of these other workers had immigration papers. Hiring an illegal immigrant is a 5-year federal felony. So they could have, if any one of these workers had filed a claim, which they didn't, they could have excluded that worker because he was illegally hired, knowingly, by Olivas. And on top of that, their policy says that Acuity doesn't even have the duty to defend. So Acuity would have, I'm sure, asserted their rights under the policy and said, I'm sorry that you, Mr. Olivas, you hired this illegally. He's excluded, and we don't even have the right to the duty to defend you.
Well, there's a question as to whether that's a valid provision in the contract.
Well, it's in the contract, yes. That would have to be litigated, but certainly that is a possibility. And to get to the other point about who provided the materials, if you look at PBAPP 71, this is during Mr. Flynn's cross-examination, but the court interrupted and asked Mr. Olivas, who paid for the drywall? Steve would pay us, the witness. Where did the drywall come from? The answer by the witness, Steve would buy it. He would buy all of the drywall, all of the materials. Not just the drywall, all of the materials.
So he would buy the drywall material, and would he also select the job?
Yes. The testimony was that Tempest really had the control, because he found the original jobs. Then he would come to Olivas and his people and say, I have this job. He would measure the square footage of the job to be done, and then he would determine the rate to pay them. It was not an independent contractor would bid out a job. Tempest would go to an independent contractor and say, how much will you do this work for? In this case, Tempest would say, it's 10,000 square foot or feet, therefore I will pay you this amount. Now, square footage is square footage, but the rate paid per square foot, Tempest determined that. That's clear in the testimony. The workers had no say. The only thing they provided was their hammers and any other small equipment that they needed.
Mr. Do you agree that it was Mr. Olivas' burden to prove independent contractor status for the people with whom he worked under 8B?
No.
Why not?
Because, first of all, this is a claim for damages. I'm sorry, for a contract, a breach of contract, for premiums. We're not dealing with a worker injured. We're not at the claim stage. We're at the premium stage. And because of that, I believe that it is important to have the burden of proof on the company, the insurance company, who's in a better position to make those proofs, as opposed to an unsophisticated small subcontractor who may or may not know how to read. In this case, didn't read very much English, didn't speak very much English, testified he didn't get the policy till 2 months after he paid for it, and that nobody ever explained it to him. So,
Counselor, do you agree that it is the definition of independent contractor found in the statute, rather than the common law definition applied by the Court of Appeals, that is the correct definition to be applying to these workers?
I believe so. I believe that 9B is the correct definition of an independent contractor. However, I think the Court of Appeals was correct in saying that Acuity did not meet its burden of proof, and supported what the findings of the trial court that also said acuity did not meet its burden of proof.
Also, is that 8B? You mean 8B?
8B. Did I say 9? Sorry.
Somebody said 9.
Yeah, it's 8B.
8B. 8B. Okay. Right.
What was the burden? You're saying that the burden of proof was not met. What burden did acuity have? What were they supposed to establish?
Acuity was supposed to establish that the workers who were working alongside Mr. Olivas were his employees, or in the alternative, that they were independent contractors. They couldn't prove that he was an employee, the trial court said. And so then they came on the appeal. They said, we win anyway because Olivas didn't prove that these workers were independent contractors. And if they're not independent contractors, then they're his employees. Well, if you look at the definition under 10274, that defines what an employee is. And the testimony of the auditor went specific to those factors there. She said that based on the 1099s, it meant that Olivas was the only one who was paid by Tempest, and that because they went to work together and did the same job side by side, that he exercised control over them, and therefore he was their employer.
Well, he had to tell them what to do, couldn't he, because they couldn't speak English.
Well, he was a translator because he testified that all of them were experienced drywallers, so there wasn't much to tell them other than how much they were going to get paid for the job and where the job was. Tempest was the one who was the power behind all this. He made the payments. He got the first job. He got the jobs first, and he testified that he would deal with Olivas because Olivas spoke more English, but he also testified that on occasion when Olivas was not present, he would try to communicate and explain the job to the other workers, and that if he had a recommendation, he would give it to them. So it's not like he exclusively worked with Olivas.
It's not like who exclusively worked for
Olivas.
Okay.
The drywall contractor.
But the converse is true, as I understand the facts, that Olivas exclusively worked for Tempest, didn't he?
The testimony by Olivas, and I believe I'm not sure about his fellow worker, but it was clear that they only worked for Tempest that year.
And one of the things that is at the heart of the independent contractor doctrine is that they hold themselves out to the public to provide services. And otherwise, all employees, we could just say, oh, you're all independent contractors. That way we don't have to pay workers' comp insurance. We don't have to withhold Social Security, we don't have to pay any kind of employer's tax, we don't have to do any of that. I mean, if I were an employer, I might like all of my employees to be independent contractors. And of course, we've seen that in certain industries. But does the record reflect any time during the relevant year that either Olivas or any of these people that were working at his side held themselves out to the public to provide services?
No. I specifically asked that question. And while I believe that under Jarrett and the new statute, that's not a requirement anymore. It's not one of the elements to prove independent contractor. That was in the record, that they only did work for Tempest, and none of them held out themselves to the public to be independent contractors, or that they did drywall for the public. And Tempest testified that he thought maybe they had done one small job for somebody else, but he wasn't sure. Olivas said, no, we only did work in that year for Tempest.
And your response to me in part is that test, holding yourselves out to the public, the legislature is really refined and replaced with these nine elements that all must be met.
Correct. And it's our position, members of the court, that under Labor Ready, you first have to determine whether these people were employees. And if they were, who were they working for? Acuity says, if you have a situation like this, you first check to see if they're independent contractors. If they're not, then they're employees. But they take the position they're employees of Olivas. I think, Justice Bradley, you properly came to the right conclusion that if they were employees, they were employees more of Tempest than of Olivas. But I don't believe that you have to get there, because even if they were correct in that, they had the burden of proving that these people were excluded because they were independent contractors, and they didn't meet any. They didn't meet either test. The court clearly found that. What muddied the water here, I think, a little bit was that the trial court said, "I find that these fellas are not employees under Chapter 102, which I read to mean there was no employer-employee relationship under Chapter 102 in this situation. Then the court said, the trial court, the test is under 102.078B, and then it made about five or six findings, didn't make nine findings, and not all of them were consistent with the nine elements of that section. And that's when Acuity said, aha, they didn't meet their burden of proof, and the court's findings don't support that these people were independent contractors, therefore they must be employees. And we don't believe that it was Olivas' duty or burden to make that proof. It was their burden. And I think you may find some fault with the reasoning of the appellate court on the applicability of 8B, but I don't think you can find fault with their conclusion that Acuity failed to meet its burden of proof.
Well, the Court of Appeals said in paragraph 11, Olivas stated that the common law definition of independent contractor controlled. Is that your position now? Olivas stated that the common law definition of independent contractor controlled.
That's not our position at this time, Your Honor.
Okay. But that's what the Court of Appeals said was your position. Okay.
No. One other thing that I meant.
The Court of Appeals said, okay, the trial court didn't look at the common law definition, but looked at 8B, and then, as you say, they went through some of the elements of 8B, but not others. Now, what is your position now? Is it your position before this court, and I think this is the legal issue, we can then talk about the facts, legal issue as I understand it, the trial court said 8B applied, that determines whether it's an independent contract. The Court of Appeals said, nope, this is no workers' comp case. This is a contract case. And we look at the insurance contract. And under the insurance contract, they go to look at independent contractor under common law. And then they finally wind up saying, Acuity failed to establish that the other workers were employees and not self-employed contractors, which is independent contractors, who happened to work as a team. So the Court of Appeals did it under common law. The trial court did it under 8B. I hear your argument as trial court's right on the law, namely 8B applies.
No.
You don't think that?
No.
Okay. What do you think?
The trial court said, I don't, and I'll get right away to the section that I think it ruled under.
All right.
It says, I find that these fellas are not employees under Chapter 102. What it did was, it was referring to 102.074A, which defines employee as every person in the service of another under any contract of hire, express, or implied. If the court had just stopped right there, we wouldn't have muddied the water so much. And the reason I believe that is because all of the testimony of Acuity's witness, main witness, the auditor, related to the elements of that section. The court in Labor Ready went on, when interpreting that section, it said, the principal test for determining whether a Chapter 102 employer-employee relationship exists is whether the alleged employer had the right to control the details of the employee's work. And then there are four secondary factors that were cited in Labor Ready. And those are the factors that the auditor was testifying to when she said that she concluded that these people were Olivas' employees. The trial court got mixed up on the law there, but I think it made the right decision under 102.074A. And the trial and the circuit court, I'm sorry, the Court of Appeals affirmed that also by saying that, by placing the burden of proof on Acuity and saying they didn't meet the burden of proof that these people were employees of Olivas. So they're consistent there.
Counselor, you just said 4A, 102.04A. I thought before you said 4B, and if I didn't hear you correctly, tell me why you think they're not employees under 4B. Am I confusing you with my...
Well, what I meant to say was,
okay,
under 102.07,
yep,
parent 4, parent A, okay, that's the definition of an employee. And there it says, every person in the service of another under any contract of hire, express, or implied. The reason I don't think they're employees under there is because Olivas, the alleged employer, did not have the right to control the details of the employee's work. There was no direct evidence of the exercise of the right of control. The method of payment or compensation, he was paid, but he was only a funnel.
But Mr. Flores, but how about sub B then? Do they? How come they don't fit under sub B? Same paragraph.
I don't have that right here. Let me see. I have to look that up.
There's the statutes right out in front of
you. No, I have them right here. 102. Okay.
I'm looking at, just write down from where you were. 102.07 4B, like baby.
Paragraph A shall not operate to exclude an employee whose employment is in the course of any trade, business, profession, or occupation of the employer, however casual, unusual, desultory, or isolated the employer's trade, business, profession, or occupation may be. Because it's kind of circular definition. It does not operate to exclude an employee, but you first have to prove that that individual is an employee, which deals with the right of control.
Well, then your position is they're independent contractors because they don't come under 4A, right?
Our position was that they were not Olivas' employees. If they could be employees of Tempus or they could be independent contractors,
okay,
but Acuity had the burden of showing that.
Right. But 8A says that
even if they're independent contractors under 4A, that is that they are not employees, you're not, for purposes of this statute, an independent contractor unless you fulfill all of the nine provisions.
Right.
And then you're saying they don't come under 4A as an employee, and they might not come under all the nine, but Acuity had the burden and they didn't do it. They don't get a second pick at the bat.
Right.
That's
correct.
Your argument in
correct.
Total.
And there's one other critical issue here. I mentioned earlier, my yellow light is on, that there was no injury here. So Olivas is not trying to exclude somebody from coverage.
Well, Acuity thinks it was injured.
Well, but the workers' comp statute, that's right, under contract law, not under workers' comp law, they weren't injured. And under 102.03, conditions of liability, it says liability under this chapter shall exist against an employer only where the following conditions occur: where the employee sustains an injury, and where at the time of the injury, both the employer and employee are subject to the provisions of this chapter. There was no injury here. And I think that's why the Court of Appeals went in that direction of saying this is just purely a contract case, because there was, we were dealing only with premiums, not an injury. But there would be no liability against Olivas, and that my red light is on. Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Flores, may yes. I ask a question?
Sure.
Was Mr. Olivas doing drywall himself?
Yes. He was working alongside the other workers. There were, the only difference between Olivas and the other four or five individuals was that the checks were made out in his name, and then he divided them equally or pretty equally among the other workers. He did not profit. He did not withhold. And that he talked to Tempest, the general contractor, more, because he was the only one who could speak any English.
Well, let's say, hypothetically, he had a job to drywall that side of the bill.
Right.
Are you saying that he had no control over how many people showed up? I mean, if six people showed up plus himself, it seems to me what he got out of that job would be a lot less than if two people did that wall.
Well, the testimony was that he had no right to fire or hire, that the agreement between all the workers, including himself, was that they worked for their own account. That's in the testimony. That Olivas was not the crew leader, that he had no control over the others, and that he couldn't add or fire anybody from the crew. And the testimony by a co-worker, Jose Mireles, was that on occasion, when they got a bigger job, they would have to add on people, and that the crew, the whole group together, would decide if they would put somebody on or not temporarily. And that nobody was ever fired by Olivas, that some people worked or quit because it was very hard, heavy work. So he had no right to fire or hire. It was communism, I guess.
Sounds like communism to me.
Again,
I end on that note, but my red light is red.
Yes, Justice Prosser.
You have been a major figure in Wisconsin for a long time. You know how important workers' comp is to the history of the state.
Yes.
I have concerns that if the Court of Appeals is affirmed, that we're creating conditions basically to undermine the workers' comp law and leave a lot of people who are working out there without any coverage.
Well, if I may answer that, counsel for Acuity said that we have to have a balanced system. I agree that 9 B controls the definition of independent contractor. But in this case, if you find that Acuity has not met its burden of proof, the system is not going to be affected in any one way. Right now, when you buy an insurance workers' comp policy, you estimate what your payroll will be based on the number of employees you have. At the end of the year, the insurance company does an audit, and they say, you owe us or we owe you. There's no problem there. And if they say, they come to me and say, Mr. Flores, and I'm an employer because I have a small law office and I have employees, and if I hire somebody to paint the inside of my office and my insurance company says, I see you paid Woodman painters some money, they're your employees. We could dispute that, and at that stage, the burden should be on the insurance company who's trying to get more premiums from me to show that those people, in fact, are my employees, not independent contractors. Now, if one of those painters falls and breaks a leg and makes a claim, the law in Wisconsin is still clear that the workers' comp law is a beneficent law, and that the injured worker is the favorite of the law. At that point, at the claims point, not at the premium stage, the presumption is that that worker is an employee. And it is now up to me, if I'm fighting it as the employer and saying, or the insurance company is fighting it and saying, he was not an employee, the burden is on the person trying to defeat coverage at that stage. So nothing different than what goes on today. You can, at the premium stage, when there's no urgency, no worker injured, you can fight over the premiums, and the burden should be on the insurance company, who's more sophisticated and better equipped to handle the burden of proof.
Well, to your argument, Acuity has the burden either time. They always have the burden to show whether it's not an employee.
Well, they're well prepared to meet that burden, I believe.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Flores.
Thank you.
Counsel, you have about 5 minutes in rebuttal. It didn't sound like communism to me. It sounded like a joint venture. And your policy provides that the insured can be an individual or a joint venture or some other organization. Would the premiums have been different if they'd been a joint venture?
I think we would have to look at the policy that says how the premiums would be calculated, which would be we need to determine who are the employees or other persons that are liable, that would make us liable under the Act.
Listen, the seven of us are going to join, and we are going to take business for drywalling. We'll figure out how we do it as the business develops.
I think you could speak for yourself on that.
I'm the team leader. And unlike Olivas, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to have you all do it.
I have a job for you. Okay.
So, what would the premium be? Because the insured can be a joint venture. So I want to know who's covered if it's a joint venture. And what's the premium?
And my understanding, Your Honor, is if a joint venture would be involved, is you would take all the employees and you would pull the payroll and you would calculate the premium in that way.
So that's really where you're harmed. If it's a joint venture, they didn't reveal that everybody was in on it. And if it's a single insured, they didn't tell you they had employees. That's what you're saying. So you want the premium.
Well, I guess I would, on the point of whether they told or didn't tell at the beginning, I would disagree, first of all, with Mr. Flores, and we've cited the specific parts of the transcript in our reply brief where Mr. Olivas testified when he went to get the policy, he got the policy for the crew. But because I only have a few minutes, I want to bring us back full circle if I can, because the issue here...
Counsel, before you bring us back full circle, let me tell you what's troubling me about this case. Whatever decision we make is going to apply across the board with respect, just particularly with respect to who has the burden in workers' comp cases in the future. And what's troubling me about this case is what everybody is delicately tiptoeing around, and the fact that you have Tempest, who's bringing in Olivas and ostensibly of workers to come in and do some work, where only one of them is documented and the others are not, and therefore everything goes through Olivas. So he's the one, and from what I understood the argument to be, he gets the paycheck. Now, he disperses it. Everybody gets their share. But he gets the paycheck, and as the chief pointed out, well, this is kind of like a joint venture. And my concern is that, okay, now here comes Acuity and says, okay, well, yeah, it was kind of a joint venture, so we'll treat it like a joint venture. You give us our share of the full payments of the policies, so we want the amount for the full payment, the $170,000, not the $28,000 that Olivas got. But whatever rule of law we're going to apply is going to be applied knowing that in the backdrop, factually in this case, there are a lot of people who have reasons not to fess up as to what went on here. So when I look at who's got the burden, it seems that the burden is going to be hard for whoever has it because everyone's got a reason to kind of hold back. So we're really not getting the full gist of the facts of the case here. And that's what's concerned me. I mean, I'm sitting here and looking at Tempest in the background, and, you know, it seems that he knows what's going on here. He knows that you've got this crew. He sees them coming and going, but he's only paying Olivas. The insurance company issues a policy. It's issued to Olivas. Now, all these other workers are out there, and whatever rule of law we establish is going to apply for workers' comp for everyone in the state. So I'm concerned about this burden of proof and how it should be assessed, because this is going to apply to everybody from this point on.
And that was the concern that Acuity had and why we filed the petition, because the rule would apply across the state. But I can appreciate that there may be concerns with respect to Tempest's role in the arrangement of the original situation, but this policy isn't a policy that Acuity wrote for Tempest.
My understanding is that Olivas didn't even get the policy, according to the transcript, until 2 months after it was enforced.
He got a copy of it, but
I'm just going by what was in the transcript. So.
Right. I guess in my experience, when I get an auto policy, I generally don't get the policy right when I pay my initial premium. But the point of getting the policy...
The concern is that you've got a person who doesn't speak English, who has to go through, well, who goes through an interpreter, who is trying to work out all these arrangements. When everybody's trying to work out a convenient relationship to make sure that this work gets done, and the bottom line was that the work is going to get done. And I'm just concerned. That's why, to me, this is really a burden of proof case and where it should line up. So my question is, and it kind of goes back to the other questions the other members of the court have, on the contract issue, who's got the burden, and on showing who's an independent contractor, who's got the burden. And if you split them up, please.
The burden on the contract, Acuity is asserting additional premiums. While we disagree with much of what was in the Court of Appeals opinion as to which test to apply, we, in our brief, we don't quarrel that we have to establish that there was a contract for the purchase of the premiums.
And you have to establish that there's a breach, correct?
That there is a breach. We believe that additional premiums were owed under the contract and the additional premiums were not paid. There's the breach.
Your position is that you define independent contractor and an employee under workers' comp.
That's what the contract does.
And that, therefore, was under. You had the obligation to show that these people were employees, not independent contractors.
Correct.
You disagree with the trial court that found they were independent contractors under the compensation law.
That's correct.
You think you carried your burden?
Well, the trial court, yes, we do believe we carried our burden because we don't believe that there was sufficient evidence at trial
to support the findings.
That's correct.
Okay. You were going to sum up and set us straight. Before you do that, I'm giving you extra time to, because we gave extra time to Mr. Flores.
Chief. Justice Bratton. Thank you, Chief. Mr. Flores suggested in a comment in his argument that you would have as a defense for payment for a claim, the defense that these workers are illegal workers and therefore you don't, since they are illegal here, violating the law, subjecting the employer to federal sanctions for violating the law, that you don't, if they were injured, you could raise that as a defense. They're illegal.
My understanding is if a worker, whether illegal or not, is injured as an employee, they're entitled to benefits. They're entitled to compensation.
Now, I know the workers' compensation law had and still has lots of provisions for farm workers, for seasonal laborers, which would typically be a migrant, you know, working population, and deals with them specifically, children, relatives, all that stuff. There's nothing that I know of in the law that I'm aware of that specifically deals with your obligation as a workers' comp insurer to pay a claim with regard to an injured employee who violates the law. I don't know of any law that controls that.
As I stand here today, Justice Bradley, I couldn't cite to you a specific section myself.
Is there any provision in your contract that addresses that?
The contract, in terms of the calculation of the premium, cross-references liability under the Act.
Counselor, it was Mr. Flores' assertion that if there were an injury and QE didn't want to pay, it'd be their burden under 8B to show that the injured person was an independent contractor. And I don't think there's a lot of confusion about that in the law. He also then asserted it's still your burden under 8B. And I'm having a little trouble with that because it would be your burden to stand the statute on its head and to prove they were not independent contractors. And I'm missing something here, and maybe you can help me why he thinks there's a burden on acuity under 8B. Did you understand better? I seem to have gotten off the track on that one.
As I understand it, the burden would be the you would look at 8A.
Right.
Because 8A says every independent contractor, for the purposes of this chapter, is an employee. And then B says you have to reach the exception.
I probably just heard him wrong. He probably said 8A and I wrote 8B down, and that makes more sense to me.
Who proves?
You would say acuity has the burden to show that this independent contractor, if that's what you're characterizing him as, was an employee under 8A.
Performing service in the course of trade, business, profession, or occupation of such employer. So to distinguish the drywall contractor who fixes a problem at Mr. Flores' law office from a drywaller who's working in Mr. Olivas, with Mr. Olivas, and they're doing drywall together, that's where the 8A comes in.
Okay. Who has to prove that 9B wasn't satisfied? That 8B wasn't satisfied. The 9 qualifications.
Well, I think in the context of this case, Mr. Olivas needs to establish that the 9 points are satisfied because the statute says The independent contractor has to meet all the tests, and we believe that's how the burden should line up.
Thank you very much.
Even though you're the plaintiff here, usually the burden of proof is on the plaintiff.
But as Mr. Flores pointed out, the overarching policy behind the compact is to bring people in. And that's what 8A says. And I believe we've met our burden under 8A to establish the liability. And so then the burden to defeat the liability for the premiums would fall to the person trying to establish the exception to coverage.
Well, the trial court erred in putting the burden on you.
I can't tell from the trial court's ruling its oral decision exactly how the trial court saw the burden. It just concluded that the 9 points had been satisfied.
And the Court of Appeals put the burden on you? But under the common law, okay, which you object to.
And at one point I think I heard Mr. Flores object to it too, which I think is appropriate. And that's where I just wanted to bring us back to is there appears to be some agreement that the test for independent contractor, and to address Justice Butler's concern, it's very important from acuity standpoint, from the amicus standpoint, that the clear rule that establish what test applies, whether the premium context or the injury context, that there be a very clear statement on that. And we would submit that acuity's analysis is the one that provides a consistent system that protects the workers because it brings more workers into the system. And it's consistent with the statute, and it's consistent with the legislative intent. And so we believe the Court of Appeals should be reversed for those reasons.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Flores, and for this interesting argument on workers' compensation. That concludes our hearing in 05AP685, Acuity Mutual versus Miguel Olivas, and the court will meet in closed session at 3:25.